This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 8, 1966 Part 2 with Russell Sellers.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Ben Morse. How you doing? You're listening to Marvel Age Masterclass, the chillest podcast on all of Place to Be Nation. Pop! I'm lounging backyard here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Balmy Las Vegas, Nevada. It's a dry heat hitting me right in the face here in the entertainment capital of the world. But I've got one very important question on my mind before we dive into this second half of 1966, a Marvel Age Masterclass. And the question on my mind is, how is Russell Sellers doing?
Came to get some mo' kicks from 1966.
You didn't say it on the main podcast, and I was so bummed. I was listening.
I know, man.
For the whole time, man. You made a pretty strong commitment last time we did Masterclass, that you were going to lean in heavy to the getting kicks in 1966 catchphrase, and then it is nowhere to be found on the most recent edition of Marvel Age.
You know, you make a fair point.
Yeah.
And
more than fair.
I gotta say, though, man, the back half of 1966 just didn't feel like it was giving me a lot of kick, you know?
Didn't feel like you were getting the kicks?
Didn't feel like I was getting a lot of kick. There were a few kicks, though, and they were strong where they were. Yeah. But there's a lot of in the second half.
I feel like the first half of 1966 was like karate kicks.
Yeah.
And the second half of 1966 is like kick cereal.
Yeah.
It's very bland. Right now, there's some good stuff to talk about. We'll go through it. Like you said, you and I talked about this beforehand. We're like, we're just going to kind of blow through the second half of 1966.
Sure.
The first half, we talked about Amazing Spider-Man, the Steve Ditko to John Romita senior handoff, the Green Goblin secret identity, the final chapter, Dr. Octopus is the master planner, all that great stuff. Then we talked about Fantastic Four, Inhumans, Galactus, This Man, This Monster, Black Panther, so much stuff. And then I was like, what else happened in 1966? And I listened to Marvel Age, which, by the way, is the sister podcast to Marvel Age Masterclass. It's where Russell, along with Todd Weber, Tim Capel, Nick Duke, they discuss year by year the history of Marvel Comics, and then one of them comes on here with me and dissects it. So if you're listening to this for the first time, that's how this all works. But you guys ran through so many comics on the most recent edition of Marvel Age, but yeah, a lot of it was just kind of there.
Yeah, that's exactly how it felt. Like, as we're going through that back half of 66, I mean, it's tough to follow that first half whenever we've just gone through the Galactus saga and all this great stuff with Amazing Spider-Man. So it's like, all right, what's our first issue? Tales of Suspense 78. And who gives a shit?
That's
where I was.
So listen, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to discuss these with you in the order of, I know you guys just, I don't know how you set things up on Marvel Age.
Yeah.
Just to give you guys a little hint of how the sausage is made, I know nothing about how they run Marvel Age. It's just a free-for-all over there. I don't know how you guys pick the order in which you discuss stuff, but to me, it makes sense. Like, let's talk about the best stuff first, so we give it our most energy and most time. And then if we, like, are running low and we need to skip Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., then we'll do that.
Hey, I got to tell you, that's exactly how I did it in the reading.
Yeah, right?
I was like, let me read the fun stuff first, the really good stuff. And if there's time, I'll get to the stuff that's not necessarily in the noted parts of our reading. Because we got a spreadsheet dedicated to all this. So that's how we're deciding what parts of it are most important and what's skippable.
Yeah, and that's what you get here on Marvel Age Masterclass. Behind-the-scenes stories from my 10 years at Marvel, as well as behind-the-scenes stories from Russell's 3 months doing this podcast.
Yeah, about 3 months doing the podcast. But I didn't work for Marvel, but I grew up on Marvel Comics. That's, as everybody knows, my bread and butter.
All right, man. So let's talk some Marvel Comics.
Let's do it.
And I'm going to kick off not with – see, this is how – unbiased and professional I am. I said we're going to do the big stuff first. And my favorite stuff from 66, or the remainder of 66, we'll get to. Because I think objectively, the best stuff is probably a certain thunder god, Thor, stepping into his own self-titled series, no longer Journey into Mystery. We are now full-blown Thor. Interesting stuff with Thor this time around. I got some specific questions I want to pose to you, but just to summarize, Thor this time out, basically it's two stories, right?
Yeah, it's mostly focused on Ego, the Living Planet, and his introduction to the Marvel Universe, and we're kind of picking up on the where the story picks up is at the tail end of one that we didn't necessarily read, but it was a Thor and Hercules team up. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, anytime those two are on panel together, it is just gold. They are one of the unsung duos, I think, of early Marvel. They needed their own book together.
And of course, we also, not to drive by him, we get the wondrous Regellians.
Yeah.
One of the most forgotten races of aliens in Marvel Comics lore, known by Tana Nile, who's in this story, and probably, I was going to say, very little more known by the Recorders, who are, of course, part of the Regellian race.
Yes. You know, I actually liked that part of the story where the rest
you,
of the...
You said as much on Marvel Age.
Yeah, I got a lot of enjoyment out of that, mostly for the comedic aspect of it, because here's this, conqueror, or I guess that's the way she viewed herself, having been in disguise this whole time with Jane Foster and, gathering intel about Earth, and then... communicating with her race that, hey, I've found this planet. There are no rules governing this, since it's an unknown. I claim it as my own. And they were all cool with it. So she just walks out into the street like, oh, I own this now. I am your master. Hey, there's this police officer. Take me to your leader. And they just think she's insane. And the way this whole thing plays out is I kept waiting for the flip, because that seemed to have been, Stan and Jack's thing at this point, to – even though you've got a very bombastic style villain, they're going to flip this. They're totally going to make her into something that's not easily conquered. And they totally flipped the script on me and played it for laughs. And it was genius work, in my opinion.
It's funny stuff. It just shows you that Stan and Jack could do comedy, which I think they got knocked for a lot. Like, they're not thought of as – when you think of the pantheon of traditionally funny writers – you think of your Peter Davids, your Keith Giffens, modern day Chip Zdarsky, but you don't think of Stan Lee, and he has, and Kirby as well with the visuals. He had a mastery over humor that really rounded out his skill set. That I think he was actually a very funny storyteller, and that's what added to he had a few of the legitimate funny Spider-Man lines.
He did.
Because Spider-Man, basically his whole reputation for quipping and being witty comes from those original Stan Lee stories. There's funny stuff in Fantastic Four. There's funny stuff in, I would argue, we'll talk about it later. I would argue the worst comedy that Stan does is in the pages of Daredevil. But little things like Thor, Thor's a place where you can kind of flip it and say Thor's not, it's usually known for the big Shakespearean dialogue and the big action pieces. It's not a place you think you're going to find a nice funny little scene involving aliens, but there you go.
It was a nice balance, though, to this kind of serious and like you were saying, the Shakespearean and kind of bombastic stuff that's happening with Ego in the dark galaxy as it is. That part was really trippy, and I think that all those folks that were reading, the Doctor Strange stuff that Steve Ditko was doing. The artwork there is just trippy as hell, and you can tell this was definitely geared towards those kids who were dropping acid during that time. Yep. But those same kids should have been reading Thor, especially during the Ego Living Planet stuff, because, man, the trip they would have had reading that would have been like probably even more mind-blowing, because the art during that part is just some of the most gorgeous stuff that Kirby's done yet.
So here's what I want to dig into in regards to Thor. The interesting thing about Thor to me, specifically in 66, a little before then, but when Stan, Jack, Steve, etc. are starting the Marvel Universe, it's all very concentrated. And by that I mean that, you know, everyone's pretty much within a few blocks of each other in New York City.
Yeah.
That's kind of the building block of the Marvel Universe. You know, Spider-Man could run into the Fantastic Four, who could run into the Avengers, who could run into the X-Men.
Yeah.
As time goes on, you see these guys starting to expand the universe, other countries, other dimensions, and into outer space. Fantastic Four is the first to go there. They encounter the Skrulls. They encounter the Kree. They go to the moon. They go elsewhere. Doctor Strange, we've already explored, has his kind of cosmic odyssey, which is almost more interdimensional. With Thor, he was the logical choice to be kind of the first full-fledged cosmic hero, which I don't think he gets thought of in modern context. When you think of cosmic, you think of Silver Surfer, Nova, Guardians of the Galaxy. Those are the cosmic characters. But Thor, in a lot of ways, was their forebear. And you'd get stuff like Ego, the Living Planet. You'd get stuff like even Asgard itself was very extraterrestrial. It was very it was thought of as being outside the earthen realms. And what I want to talk about is the interesting thing to me is Thor works kind of on two different levels. You can do the God out of place on Earth stories, which I think are good. The first Thor movie, which to me is one of the more underrated of the Marvel Cinematic Pantheon. I know not everyone loves the Thor movies.
I actually agree with you on that.
I love the first Thor movie.
So I think
it's great. And I think a lot of that comes from, well, a lot of it comes from a talented cast, particularly Chris Hemsworth. But I think a lot of it comes from the fact that it's interesting to put this powerful, bombastic god on Earth and see what happens to him. And I think in the early Thor stories, and a lot of Thor stories since, the one set on Midgard, it really works. By the same token, you put Thor out in outer space, in the Dark Galaxy, encountering this living planet known as Ego, and all these big cosmic characters, it works equally well. I think Thor is one of the more versatile Marvel characters, because I really think you can flip him between being a big cosmic character and then also putting him on Earth and not losing anything. I think he works both ways. So I wanted to talk to you, Russell, just as your experience in the early Thor stuff. The first few Journey into Mystery stories you read obviously were, you know, Thor on Earth. He might be battling the Stone Men of Saturn, but he is linked to Earth. He is trapped as Don Blake. He's interacting with Jane Foster. He kind of started to break that mold in the annual we read where he fought Hercules. But here with Ego, you're really seeing the birth of cosmic adventurer Thor. And I wanted to get your take on that, if there was one version of Thor that you preferred, and also just what you think about his kind of elasticity as a character.
I really do prefer the full bore God of Thunder, no Donald Blake attachment whatsoever. And I think what we're seeing in this early, in these early stories, is they initially gave him that secret identity or that dual identity so that could give him a sense of duality like a lot of their other heroes have. But as time has gone on and as we have experienced more Thor stories, Donald Blake has become less and less and less and less. And eventually he will be pretty much gone. And to me, that is Stan realizing that that's what he should have done all along. And he's gradually stepping back from it to give more space for this, you know, omniscient, maybe, you know, God, like old Norse God. And that's, to me, that's what makes Thor more interesting, because he's very different from all of the other Marvel characters in that respect. And I do kind of prefer him as a cosmic level being, as opposed to just being on Earth all the time, because we've got a lot of heroes on Earth at this point.
Right.
And we don't do a lot of exploring in space outside of the Fantastic Four occasionally going there. But Thor presents this unique opportunity for them to explore the wide universe and even possibly a multiverse, considering we're coming up on what I think will be the introduction of the Nine Realms.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Once we get there, that's going to open up a whole new level of storytelling. And this, I think, was kind of the first big hint of that. Like having Thor going out and exploring these new things and finding other godlike beings that, you know, could challenge him in that way and present new and interesting like visuals for Kirby to play with. Because let's face it, when Kirby's out in space, man, he is doing his best work. He is bringing his A game, because it's like, there's nothing I have to base on reality here. I can totally make up whatever I want this to be.
And
that's my favorite Kirby, whenever he gets to just be unleashed and do what he wanted to do with no real restrictions on him. That's what you want to see. And that version of Thor allows for that probably more so than, say, Earthbound Thor, who, yeah, like you said, he's got some good stories. There's fun stuff there. But, man, Thor in space interacting with aliens and other cosmic beings and other cosmic gods, that's just top-notch stuff.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say on Thor, and I think you're right on all counts, and I think the bigger the Thor story, the better. The more epic the Thor story, the better. I think once in a while, checking in on Midgard always helps to ground him and to kind of remind him why he is a human character. But what you were saying about Donald Blake,
yeah,
I think that was Stan and Jack playing it safe in some regards.
Oh, sure.
In the sense that, yeah, you know, every other superhero character has the mild-mannered secret identity. So let's give Thor that. But I think, yeah, like what you said, I think it was always their intention to move more towards the godly stuff, the bigger stuff. And I think it was just a matter of, we need to establish him, we need to get some success, we need to create some capital, and then we can really let go and do what we want.
And you know what really helps in kind of humanizing the Thor character without Donald Blake? The backup stories in these books.
Yeah.
The
Tales of Asgard.
Yes, absolutely. And especially the stuff in these issues that had to do with the Warriors 3. Volstagg steals the show. He is absolutely hilarious. And there again, Jack proving his mettle as a comedic writer. But you also get to see Thor showing genuine concern for the people around them, even the people that they're fighting against, because he realizes these are humans and I am a god. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is serving to humanize this character in a way that the Donald Blake character was never able to. And this is so much better. I absolutely adored the Tales of Asgard stuff in these backups, and I know that I was the lone holdout in the original Tales of Asgard, that I was not digging it. I still stand by that I didn't dig that story. But this is what I like to see, and I love also that in modern Thor we get callbacks to it from Jason Aaron in his Thor God of Thunder run.
Yeah. And I think what you've hit on ultimately, and then we'll move on to our next subject, is Don Blake is a gimmick.
Yep.
Tales of Asgard is actual characterization. It's let's show the formative years of this character, how he came to be, his supporting cast, relationships, all the things that are good storytelling that I think Stan and Jack did. It just shows, honestly, as good as Stan and Jack were out of the gate, they're growing and evolving as creators. And Thor is somewhere you really see that. They're the maturation of their skill set and their ability to humanize a character through story rather than through a plot device. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say I am fully on board with you there. Their storytelling sensibilities have gotten way better.
Yeah. And I want to transition from there to another Stan and Jack collaboration. I said that Thor was objectively at least the most important, if not the best thing you guys read this particular installment. My personal favorite of the 1966 offerings outside of Fantastic Four and Amazing Spider-Man, which we're not counting for the purposes of here, is I love what Stan and Jack do with Captain America and Tales of Suspense.
Seconded.
I just, it's instantly like you can tell they're such big fans of this character. And I think you guys hit on that on Marvel Age. This is clearly a character Stan has wanted to write for a long time. And you got to remember that originally Captain America was created by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby in the Golden Age. Stan Lee's first work was working as an assistant for Joe Simon and doing Captain America tech stories. So you could literally see 20 years worth of anticipation and desire on Stan's part to script his own Captain America stories. And then, of course, with Kirby, not only is Captain America one of the first characters he designed, and I think it says something that he didn't really alter the visuals when he brought him into the Silver Age. This was, you know, he still looked the same because it's a classic design. And I think there's something to the fact that Captain America's costume today is pretty much the same costume he had in the 40s because it always works. It's a timeless design. But beyond just liking the design of Captain America, I think Kirby, he got to do the big sci-fi stuff in Thor. He got to do a variety of genres in Fantastic Four. Captain America is where he gets to do a straight action comic. And I do not mean a pun by saying action comic. but it's really a straight, you know, this guy, he doesn't have any flashy superpowers. He fights, he punches, he kicks, he does things. So I think it was twofold for Kirby. I think he enjoyed the design of Captain America, and then I think he enjoyed just the fighting prowess of Captain America. And what you get is Stan and Jack really pouring themselves into this new feature in Tales of Suspense.
Yeah, all the Captain America stuff, just it worked big time on me. And you know, since Captain America has come back, like, he's been a very important fixture of the Avengers, but we haven't really seen much of him running solo. And in this story, I gotta say, I prefer him running solo. I really dug the hell out of what they were doing with him. Because like you pointed out, you've got a character who at this point is being portrayed as not really having superpowers. They're not even really portraying him as a super soldier. They've even said on panel that he doesn't have any powers at all. So you've got a guy who's got great fighting prowess and is, you know, reasonably intelligent, I would say, but now you're going to put him up against not only his returning greatest foe in the Red Skull, but you're going to give Red Skull the Cosmic Cube. And that's the big thing that happens to me in this back half of 66. Yeah, sure, we got Ego the Living Planet, and that's going to become a big deal later, but the Cosmic Cube, that's a big deal throughout Marvel history. And this is its first appearance, and it is used to great effect, giving Captain America something that he can't necessarily punch his way out of. He's got to come up with a better plan to outsmart his opponent. But it's more than just that. There's a little thing in this book that I actually dug the hell out of at the beginning, and that was when Captain America is fighting seemingly an invisible enemy. Nobody else around him can see it. And they could have played that to great effect to make everyone else around him think that Captain America was losing his mind. And just the implications that were going on there, because we could hear Steve's inner thoughts. Like, we can see it on panel that he thinks he's possibly going crazy, that something has happened to him. And to me, that's like, this is Stan, like, knocking on the door of a great idea. And I know, I am for sure that it gets followed up on later, but even the stuff in the back half where he goes with the Cosmic Cube and Red Skull, all of that worked big time for me. This was the Captain America stuff that I absolutely adore, and I need more of it.
Just like we were saying, Thor works so well, where he's superpowered, outer space, written huge, big scale. I think Captain America, my favorite Captain America, is when he is, they're not focusing on the super soldier serum. This guy is not a superpowered hero. He is basically the peak of human evolution. He's yep. as fast, as strong, as smart as a human can get. And I love that they brought Red Skull back. Again, I think that's Stan working with the fact that, you know, he basically grew up in the comic book industry with these characters. So he's both a fan and a professional. But yes, the introduction of the Cosmic Cube is great because we've got non-powered Captain America juxtaposed against his worst enemy having supreme power. Because that was the one thing about the Red Skull in the Golden Age, is he was basically just a figurehead. You know, he had to have other people do his fighting for him. He was not a physical threat. But when you have the Red Skull as this mastermind who gets his hands on incredibly powerful artifacts like the Cosmic Cube, you've got something interesting there. The other thing I love about the Red Skull, and that I think makes him one of the best villains in comics, is just that. He is an out-and-out villain. There is no softer side to the Red Skull. No. There is no, I'm fighting for the mutant race. There is no, I'm trying to protect Latveria. There's no three-dimensional thing about him. And that could have very easily made him not interesting. I would argue that you see in the Mandarin a villain who lacks depth and is thus uninteresting. With Red Skull, the writers who have handled him have always done a very good job of kind of doubling down on him just being the worst, like the worst, most heinous villain, not having any redeeming value, and just plugging into that. So I think this is a great contrast where you have this epitome of heart and determination and good in Captain America working against the embodiment of evil in the Marvel Universe in the Red Skull.
Very much so. And Red Skull is one of the few villains that I actually prefer him as a kind of mustache twirling villain. I prefer him being this way. I don't want him to be, all that three dimensional. I don't feel like he has to be.
No, not at all.
I said, just let him be evil. That's what he is, because through and through he's power hungry. He's power mad, and he gets like completely drunk on it once he's got the Cosmic Cube. And to me, that was Red Skull fully realized.
Yeah. And we're going to get even better. Believe it or not, Captain America gets better as we go here.
Bring it. I'm ready.
I'm promising you. This is one of the first. When I went back and read old Marvel stuff to kind of educate myself and to try to get myself caught up on things I wasn't aware of, Spider-Man and Fantastic Four were kind of my go-tos. I was like, oh, these are the pillars. These are the things I need to read. And then I just randomly one day picked up a Marvel Masterworks Captain America reprinting these Tales of Suspense stories. And I was just blown away by how good they are. I think in the same way Doctor Strange kind of takes you by surprise, because it's not the one everybody talks about. Everybody talks about Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, as being kind of, even Thor to some extent, I think, has a good reputation. But I think Doctor Strange is underrated. And I think we've seen that X-Men is underrated. And then I think really Captain America is good, solid stuff. It's not, I'll say it right now, it's not groundbreaking. It's not doing things that FF and Spidey were doing in terms of like rewriting the superhero genre. It's just good quality stuff. Great art, solid writing, characters you can really get behind, just done well. So I think it's some of the better stuff you're going to encounter in this age of Marvel.
It absolutely is, and I also love that Stan was not afraid of getting political in his comics.
No, not at all. He did it early and often.
Wore it on his sleeve in Captain America, like that. And that's what it should be. I mean, Captain America is a political character. He was
absolutely.
He was created as a piece of political propaganda. Yeah. So you've got to keep that going. That's part of who he is. And they do it to great effect because, I mean, they're still saying, you know, and I think this is a pretty universal truth, Nazis bad, punch them in the face.
Yep. Yep. It is. It's something everyone can relate to.
You'd think.
Oh, man. So listen, we've covered Thor. We've covered Captain America. I'm not going to lie to you. To me, that we're talking about the good stuff. That to me is the good stuff.
That very good
stuff. In the back half of 66. Let's run through. We still got a lot to cover, but let's run through it a little little bit scattershot. Let's try to get through as much as we can.
We got one more really great thing.
What am I missing?
Strange Tales 146.
Of course. Okay.
Doctor Strange, man.
Yes. We'll get back to the other half of Tales of Suspense in a second. Because Captain America is only one half.
Yep.
Yes. Doctor Strange. This is Ditko's swan song.
Yeah, it is.
This is Steve Ditko. This is the end for Steve Ditko. As we know him, really. He'll come back to Marvel. He'll create such legendary characters as Speedball. And Squirrel Girl, but he really, his big contributions to the Silver Age of comics end here. He was already off Spider-Man. This is his final Doctor Strange, scripted, as you guys noted, by Denny O'Neill, young Denny O'Neill, the first real non-Stan writer, not counting Larry Lieber, of course, to show up here. I, like you guys, honestly, was not aware that Denny O'Neill predated Roy Thomas in terms of this. I thought Roy Thomas was the kind of like the second Marvel writer. But let's talk about for a sec this big finale for Ditko on Doctor Strange, which sees Dormammu taking on Eternity in a huge, huge grudge match. That's really, when you want to talk larger than life, that's about as big as it gets. And what did you like about this story, and how does it serve as kind of a final statement on Doctor Strange by Steve Ditko?
It's an interesting thing because this, the final issue for Ditko is not really about Doctor Strange.
I know, right?
I was
trying to think of a way to say that.
Stephen Strange is a secondary character in his own story. This is about...
He's an observer. He's the observer of what's going on.
He's watching this fight happen. He's standing back like, I don't want any of this. I'm here, but... you know, he was drug into... Dormammu's realm so that Dormammu could destroy him. Dormammu thought that he could put Eternity to sleep or like hide all this from him. And no, that's not how that works. Eternity comes out in all his glory. And I got to tell you, man, Ditko's design there was just, he was like, oh, you think Kirby can do this? Okay. let me show you something. And yeah, it's the design on Eternity can't be fully described. You just have to see it for yourself. But it is something that will leave your jaw agape, as it did me. And seeing this big fight between Eternity and Dormammu, it did not disappoint. It was everything it was built up to be. This was the big, crazy, interdimensional, magic-filled battle that we had all hoped to see in art that just steals the show. You don't even care what people are saying. You're just looking at this like I'm witnessing something that is, it's kind of once in a lifetime. Like you're not going to see something this like epic and dramatic maybe in any other comic for a good long while. So just sit back and enjoy the ride.
When you say once in a lifetime, you're not talking about like John Cena and The Rock where they fight again the next year.
Oh, no. Not quite that. But you mean The Rock was in the ring by himself. I couldn't see the other guy.
The thing that I'll send out here as I blow past your John Cena joke, fantastic stuff. But the thing I'll send out here is that much like Captain America has not changed visually from the 40s to today, you haven't seen anyone try to reinvent Eternity.
Nor should they.
Yeah, I was going to say, and with good reason. Ditko nailed it. There's no other way. I mean, how could you make Eternity more appealing? He's just such a cool design. He's so out there. Looks so different from anything else going on in comics. Not just, he doesn't just stand out in the Doctor Strange comic. He stands out as being visually distinct from everything else. Marvel, DC, I don't care what you're telling me. Nothing looks quite like Eternity. And I think this is kind of cool because it's showing Ditko's range in that he drew, as we've said, it was always kind of the contrast of he's doing these great Earthbound Spider-Man stories, but at the same time, he's doing these dimension-hopping, cosmic, crazy Doctor Strange stories. And Eternity, to me, is the capstone of Ditko's creativity. It's where he really stretches out and shows all that he can do. If ever there was a design he put his all into, it was Eternity.
You could kind of, it gave me the feeling that knowing that this was going to be his last issue at Marvel, at this point he probably thought it might have been, you know, his last issue ever.
Yeah.
So he pulled out all the stops and says, I'm just going to go for broke and put everything into this that I possibly can. So the distinguished competition maybe over at DC might be like, huh, that Steve Ditko guy.
Right.
And man, what an accomplishment that, that Strange Tales 146 is. That's, man, even if that was the only issue he ever drew in comics, it would still be talked about as legendary and his status would be firmly established.
There you go. All right. So Thor, Captain America, Doctor Strange, the big three of 1966. Are you ready, Russell, to do some quick hits?
Yeah, because that's what the rest of this is going to be.
On the rest of 1966. There are some good talking points, though. There's some stuff I want to touch on. I actually want to get into Avengers for a second. Okay. Because Avengers, to me, is becoming a very interesting title. We had said that Avengers experienced kind of a little bit of a bounce when Captain America joined, because you could tell, again, Kirby and Lee are so enamored with Captain America. Then when things were getting a little stale again, they replaced the entire cast. They bring in Hawkeye, Scarlet Witch, and Quicksilver. In 66, Captain America gets his own series, as we've covered. So no longer are Stan and Jack necessarily telling, and it's not even Stan and Jack at this point, it's Stan and whoever's drawing Avengers, but it's no longer, this is not your place to find Captain America anymore. So I think they lean heavy into the soap opera. That's what really becomes a big thing. In the second issue you guys discussed, there's of course the first issue where they fight Dr. Doom, which I think honestly doesn't do much other than to illustrate that they're the secondary at best team of Marvel.
And what a thing to say about your team up of all these heroes too.
Yeah, I know. But it's just like it's so evidenced when they go up against the Fantastic Four villain that these guys are not in the same league at the moment as the Fantastic Four.
Certainly.
And I think the Avengers gain their reputation not till years later. I mean, certainly not till 2004 did they really put all the A-list characters on the team in terms of creating the new Avengers. But it's really not till the 70s or 80s that the Avengers are treated, at least in-universe, like the A team of the Marvel Earth. They're not deferred to yet. At this point, they really are seen as secondary to the FF. But the thing they did have going for them, and I think in a sense, this was Stan kind of just throwing stuff against the wall, trying to get something to work in Avengers. You see in that second issue with the Hawkeye, Scarlet Witch, Black Widow, all that stuff that's going on. It's very much, you know, the romance aspect, human aspect. And you get villains like Swordsman and Power Man. Just kind of, what can we... I really think it was just like, it was a ticking time bomb on Avengers as far as Stan just going, what the hell can I do to keep myself interested in this book? And you're starting to see him stretch to the point where, much like we've talked about in some other characters like Nick Fury or characters like Daredevil, you're getting to the point where you really need someone, a new voice to come in here to make this work.
He did. You can kind of tell that Stan was really stretching himself to figure out what kind of story he could even tell with these characters. But I'll be honest, I liked 29 better than I liked 25. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a more entertaining story overall, and actually had a little. It had more intrigue going on, because even though I got a kick out of the whole Avengers versus fake news thing, and in 25. I really just liked 29 better. I thought that the characterizations were better. I felt like the drama, like you were pointing out, was more intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like he was more into the, like you were pointing out, the soap opera aspect of it. And when he steered fully into that in 29, I suddenly cared about what was going on with these characters. As far as the action was concerned, it was just whatever. But when it came to the characterization and like how they interacted with each other and the genuine concern that they showed for one another, I was like, okay, I can get on board with this. This feels like a team dynamic that I can enjoy.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to contrast to today, where Avengers is the big action book. That's where you have your biggest heroes, your movie star heroes fighting these insane threats. I mean, look at Jason Aaron's Avengers right now with the Celestials being brought in. And you see more of the soap opera aspect in your X-Men, in even your Fantastic Four. It's more of a personal story. But in 1966, Fantastic Four is the big action comic of Marvel in terms of a team book, and Avengers is starting to work, if it's working, like you said, with issue 29, when they get more street level, humanized, we can actually care about these characters. There are things going on with them that we can relate to. Avengers is actually the more relatable title probably in 1966.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, we only read the two issues of it, and, in those, it was like, okay, well, this is certainly more focused on showing us how this team works together more so than what's the big action set piece that they're going to get. Honestly, in 25, there wasn't much of an action set piece to speak of. It was just, okay, they're trying to figure out how to escape from Latveria and save this little this child who has the cancer. And that's really the crux of the issue. And yeah, it's, you know, I was kind of expecting, you know, Avengers versus Dr. Doom, like, you know, let's get in a little fisticuffs here, but that didn't happen. Maybe I'll get that Captain America Doom fight later, but
let's see it.
What we do get though is an establishment of why these four characters, really like jive together. Like, why does this work? Why does Cap like these characters? Why does he work with them? And I gotta admit, I actually really dug all the stuff that was going on with Hawkeye and Captain America. Like, they're kind of adversarial. Hawkeye's being a bit of a dick about it. But as he comes around and as he evolves, their relationship changes, especially there by the end of issue 29. And it's like, okay, well, now they've had it out. They've had the little argument. And now I feel like we've established a rapport. And and that's what I was looking for.
I feel like Cap and Hawkeye is a unique relationship in the Marvel pantheon. They relate to each other in a way. They're really the kind of like brothers in arms. And it's really like the older brother, younger brother dynamic with Reed and Ben. At this point, you have kind of the best friends, but at some level they are equal. With Hawkeye and Cap, I think you just see a new dynamic. They're trying something different, and they are bickering, but there is this high level of mutual respect. It's something that makes Avengers stand out, and I think that's something Avengers desperately needs at this point.
It really did, and they found a way to hit on it, though, so I found myself getting invested in what was going on with those two characters, and hopefully they'll steer further into that as we go along in these years, and you know, maybe Avengers will eventually become a really interesting title. It won't, but, you know, I'm...
No, here's the thing, man. Avengers does get good.
yeah, but they're long. Where's Brian Michael Bendis when we need him?
There are long periods of kind of just blah, not even bad Avengers stories, just blah Avengers stories where it's really just treading water. But you got some good stuff coming up. I mean, you get some writers who really want to prove themselves and are given Avengers to do it. Specifically, we got Roy Thomas coming up. A little later on, we'll have, you know, the likes of like Steve Englehart. You'll get some good stuff. But let's move on quickly and talk about one of the more disappointing titles, I would say, in these early Marvel years, and that's Daredevil. Mm-hmm. Man, just can't get into Daredevil. And I think one of the things that hurts Daredevil is, we've talked about it before, he just feels like a second-rate Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He doesn't have anything too unique to him. And I think where we see this the most is that Daredevil has a Spider-Man-like supporting cast and a Spider-Man-like gallery of villains, and neither are any good.
Yeah.
Karen Page and Foggy Nelson are not as interesting as Spider-Man supporting characters. And the villain we meet in 1966, the Gladiator, is just... There's nothing to him. He's just paper thin.
I read him as vaguely Russian and Austrian, yeah. So that kind of helped a little. Like gave him Schwarzenegger voice, and it's hilarious. But I got to tell you, that issue was one of the all time worst in Stan's pantheon, because my God, man. Like he writes Karen Page as a complete dolt.
Yep.
Foggy Nelson is a bumbling, unlikable idiot. Matt Murdock, I don't know. It seems like he's almost an observer in his own book through pretty much the entire issue. Like as you pointed out, the villain is gloriously uninteresting, and it's like this is one of the early examples I can think of where they just threw as much stupid shit on his costume as they possibly could to try and make him seem threatening. And all you really get is just, he's a clown. He's a complete and utter clown.
Right.
And then
he never got the buzzsaw.
Yeah. The buzzsaw on his wrist.
Very weird to me.
It seems like, man, don't pivot your wrist back too far. You'll be missing a knuckle or two.
It seems very much like those buzzsaws could only hurt one person, and that's Gladiator.
Yeah, it's like the person wearing it is the person most in danger of being harmed by them. And it is utterly ridiculous. And then you've got people who actually thought, huh, Daredevil's a lot fatter up close than I thought he'd be. And at that point, I've got my face fully in my hands at that point. Like, this cannot be what you thought was a good idea. Like, are you really going to play Daredevil for laughs? You shouldn't. And the thing is, though, that there's a meta moment in this issue where Daredevil is watching Foggy pretend to be Daredevil. And he thinks to himself, man, do I talk that much during a fight?
Yeah, right.
I really shouldn't do that anymore. And then for the rest of the issue, Daredevil, we hear him because we're reading his thought bubbles, but he doesn't actually speak. He just goes into combat with Gladiator, and that was the best part of the book because it's drawn it's drawn really well.
Yeah.
And then we skip over that. And get to our ending where, I gotta tell you, Karen Page is just, my God, Stan, what were you doing, man? What were you thinking? What are you thinking?
It's interesting that Matt Murdock figures Daredevil out before any creator does.
Yeah. that's the thing. It's like, he's starting to evolve a little bit. We're seeing those little pieces, and it's like the seeds are being planted for future writers, but somebody else needs to take this book over.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, it doesn't get better for a while.
Probably not until what, Frank Miller?
I think we'll see some interesting stuff in the 70s with Denny O'Neill.
Right.
Well, but that's the thing. Is the interesting thing about the Denny O'Neill Daredevil is it's not universally loved and it's not universally hated. It's not one of the runs you necessarily think of as being a fan favorite, but a lot of creators take inspiration from it, in the sense that that's when he's first paired with Black Widow. That's when he goes to San Francisco for the first time. So you see a lot of creators, modern day creators, mine the Denny O'Neill stuff. So I'll be interested if we get to reread that, when we reread it and kind of reevaluating it.
We're not far off from the 70s now, so
yeah, we'll get there pretty soon. We'll talk about it then. One thing I don't want to talk about pretty much ever when we're talking about early Marvel is Iron Man, one of the more unfortunate comics of the early Marvel years. Of course, the other half of Tales of Suspense with Captain America. So let's not talk about Iron Man, but let's talk briefly about its artist, Gene Colan. Another big creative discovery, another big creative force. It was always interesting to me that as good as he was on Iron Man, he would really find his niche in a few years when he starts drawing horror comics. Of course, he was synonymous with Tomb of Dracula and books like that. That's why it's so interesting to see him doing a superhero book, because we know how good he is at like this dark, shadowy stuff. To see him doing a really not even just a superhero book, but Iron Man, the most polished, you know, technologically future facing superhero. And you know, even here though, you see that Gene Colan has the goods. He's able to really distinguish himself.
I have nothing negative to say about the art on on either the front or back half of Tales of Suspense. It is all fantastic, and Gene Colan is one of the all-time greats, probably somebody who deserves a lot more praise than he gets. And I actually really love the way that he draws Iron Man. I love the way that he drew the action scenes, and the overly verbose, boring courtroom stuff that was going on in the other parts of that story. But That's really the only good things I can say about the Iron Man stuff, because otherwise, my God, this is a boring slog that I skimmed it, man. I couldn't even get to the point of actually reading it for any kind of pleasure. I started thinking nobody was reading this to enjoy in 66. There's no way in hell anybody would ever just choose to do this. You'd buy that book. If you were, buying that book, you're like, man, this front half is just shit. And then you get to the Captain America stuff and you're like, oh, here we go.
Yeah, exactly. I think that was, I wonder how much marketing played a role in 1966 Marvel, where they're like, we're not going to put, if we put Doctor Strange and Captain America together, they don't really need each other. They're both good. Mm-hmm. But we also don't want to combine Iron Man with, say, and let's talk about Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., which, again, not as bad as Iron Man. I would argue that Iron Man, art aside, is actively bad at this point. Nick Fury still suffers, as we've said, from just kind of being there and uninspired. It's not you described Iron Man as a slog to read. Mm-hmm. I would say Nick Fury is just kind of ponderous. They're still throwing out concepts and creating stuff on a low level that is interesting, AIM and all the other stuff going on there. But Nick Fury still hasn't hit as a leading man. They still haven't really figured out the S.H.I.E.L.D. dynamics. And I don't have a lot to say about Nick Fury. Russell, if you have anything to say, let's say it and then move on.
The worst part of it is that they're still writing Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Secret Agent Nick Fury, like he's an army grunt.
Sure.
That's
they haven't discovered. They haven't discovered the nuances that make Nick Fury work yet. No, and
we'll get there. Not until Steranko comes along and reinvents the character, I don't think. And we've got a little way to go before we get there. But, not too far, actually. It's coming up pretty soon, at least in terms of art. But, the concepts that they introduced were cool. I kept waiting for some action to actually happen. And, my God, these people just talk and talk and talk. I mean, it's like this is a visual medium, and all I see are bubbles everywhere of text. And it's like, Stan, stop writing a novel, man. You're killing me. And it's, but like you said, the only thing we get out of this is AIM. It's a more Nick Fury learning how to be a secret agent and the rest of us just being bored by it. So, then that's all I got to say about that.
All right, man, let's finish things off with the final anthology book, and that's Tales to Astonish. Hank Pym No More, which is very exciting. But let's discuss whether or not what we got in this place is much better, and that is a second run for the Hulk at being a solo character, and then a starring turn for Prince Namor, the Submariner. Let's talk about these guys together for a sec, because I think there are some interesting contrasts in the sense that they essentially both came in as villains. When Hulk didn't work, he became an Avengers villain. When Namor was brought into Fantastic Four, he was a Fantastic Four villain. They gained some notoriety there. There was almost like the stale baby faces that turn heel and become more interesting. Now, this is what I didn't realize. I knew they gave Hulk and Hulk another shot and Namor his first shot. I didn't know it came as early as 66. And I would almost argue it's too soon. I think you might be a few years off. You need a little bit more time of these guys as adversaries to the heroes before the demand is there. But at the same time, to play devil's advocate, I think Marvel was really cooking in 1966. These characters were hot. They needed someone to headline these books. And why not Hulk and Namor?
I'm kind of with you there, because the Namor half of the book was pretty great to me. Not everybody in the group on the panel was on board with it, because it's slow, and it's one of those stories where really not a ton happens, but it felt like the stage was set for big things to come up. And like Thor, Namor was very much in his own world, be it the undersea world, and that's kind of where I was hoping it would stay. Of course, Namor actually does show up in those Iron Man stories that we're downing on earlier. And at that point, I was like, "Oh, this is the most interesting part of this story." And then once Namor's gone, it's like, "And we're back to meh again."
Well, I think Namor instantly becomes the most interesting part of a lot of stories.
He pretty much does, because
he's a fascinating character.
Even when nothing is happening in his story, in his main feature, I'm still just intrigued by him. I am reading everything he's saying. I'm hanging on every word. Like, what is this guy going to do now? He's become a monarch. He is trying to rule this undersea kingdom. He is dealing with, people who don't think that he's an effective ruler, who are trying to usurp him. It's just fascinating stuff to me. And then he's dealing with a natural disaster that kind of, came out of left field. So you can say what you will for the writing there. But at the same time, I'm still just intrigued as hell by it. And and that's far more than I can say for Hulk.
It's weird, man, because I feel like, I talked with Nick Duke when he was on Masterclass about kind of the narratives that have grown out of the history of comics. And what we were talking about that time was the narrative that the X-Men weren't interesting until Giant Size Number One. How that wasn't really the case. And how the X-Men were the X-Men before that. I think another narrative that has formed over time is that Hulk was a failure as a solo title early on, but then the minute he got his second chance, he was good. I feel like there's this sense that the only really bad Hulk were those first six issues in 62. And that's simply not the case. I don't know, other than the fact that it's just this pure, simple. I was talking to someone the other day, and they were saying how Hulk was like their daughter's favorite character, their small daughter. And I'm like, that's the thing, is that Hulk has this primal appeal, especially to kids, that you just, you get it. You understand Hulk smash. It's all very simple. But sometimes as we're reading this early stuff, and I love, don't get me wrong, I love the Hulk versus Thing in Fantastic Four. I enjoyed Hulk as a malevolent force in Avengers, but I don't know how Hulk stuck around as long as he did, because there's so many bad stories and we're going to see a lot more. The Hulk does not have his definitive run for many, many years. And you get a lot more stories like the ones we saw in 66 that are just not good. And you would not think this character has the longevity that he does, but somehow, like a cockroach, he just sticks around. And, you know, God damn it, eventually they get him right. Eventually they figure him out. But wow, is there a lot of crap to wade through before we get there.
So much trial and error, and lots of error.
lots of error.
The trial, I feel like, is on the reader, because it's like, will you read a book starring Hulk? Is this a thing that you will actually buy? And you know what? I buy Hulk as a, in these early days, as a villain. Of a sort.
He's fun. He's a fun, complex villain.
He's fun whenever he's taking on the Thing. That was a great fight. That was one that I think everybody was universal on that one. We were saying, that's just fantastic stuff. I like him. I even like the idea of him, like, maybe taking on another villain, like taking on, say, Dr. Doom. I think that that would, like, physically challenge him, as well as, like, mentally challenge him. Not that that's hard to do. but he's one of those characters that needs something more than what he's gotten up to this point. Like, they tried playing him as the horror character. That didn't really work out too well. They tried playing him as the villain to Avengers and to Fantastic Four, and that worked all right. That was doing okay. But I think Stan got a little too eager there. Like, he saw people starting to like Hulk again.
I think he jumped the gun.
Yeah, he did. He was like, oh, people like Hulk now, so I can totally spin him into his own stories. And it's like, yeah, well, you should have a good story to tell first.
Yeah.
And the problem is that this story sucks.
It's really a lesson in sometimes just be happy with what you got.
Yeah.
You've got Hulk succeeding as a recurring bad guy / guest star. Maybe that's all he needs to be,
you know,
for
what,
the time being.
You know what Hulk is? Hulk's a great supporting character.
Absolutely.
Hulk is not a leading man.
And we'll see if that changes in the near future. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. but we will see when the switch flips for Hulk. So that is 1966, Russell. We got our kicks, I think.
Got more than a few kicks out of 1966. Unfortunately, far fewer in the second half than in the first. But, man, the ones we got in the first half were some of the strongest kicks we've gotten out of any of these years so far. And
absolutely.
Back half still gave us some good stuff, though. Still plenty.
Hey, man, I'll put that Thor and Captain America stuff up against just about anything. That's good stuff. I think it was just the sheer volume of stuff that was being produced that, unfortunately, there were more misses than hits. But yeah, that stuff gets, in a year like 66 with Spider-Man and Fantastic Four really running at full capacity, you might overlook a Thor or a Captain America or a Doctor Strange, and there's definitely still some good stuff. And I think it's also interesting, we're starting to see some new creative voices. The Marvel Universe is starting to diversify a little, and we'll have to keep an eye on that as we move forward with this little project.
Yeah, there's some really cool stuff coming up. We've already started our reading for 67. Mm-hmm. That's going to be fun. I think there's plenty there to talk about, and I can't wait to get into that with the guys a little bit later on. That's going to be coming up pretty soon too.
So there you go, guys. Keep an eye out, or an ear out, I guess. Not an eye out. This is not a very visual medium. Comic books is not our podcast. Keep an eye out for Marvel Age next episode covering 1967. And Russell, what else do you have on the cusp as we are entering September. So almost time.
It's just about that time. The DC post-crisis management is upon us.
Yes.
You guys have been hearing the ad for it, put together by the illustrious manager of Place to Be Nation Pop and Place to Be Nation Comics. Eh? And that would be one, Mr. Todd Weber. He helped me put that ad together. It was it's really well done. I had a lot of fun doing it. And you guys will be hearing that. It'll be starting at the end of September. That's kind of tentatively where we've put it. And the first episode is going to be with Todd Weber talking about...
Who better?
Yes, exactly. Better. Like, talking about his favorite event in DC Comics, and that would be Crisis on Infinite Earths.
I'll be honest, man. It's near and dear to me as well. I love the original Crisis. That was the book where, when I was first starting to get back into comics as an adult and getting into DC for the first time, because I'd always been a Marvel kid, I remember that my girlfriend at the time, her parents, who hated me, thought it would be funny because they thought it was so hilarious that I liked comic books. They gave me a gift certificate to New England Comics. I bought the biggest book there, which was Crisis on Infinite Earths. I read it, and I fell in love with the DC Universe. So I'm interested to hear what you and Todd have to say about it.
Oh, we're going to talk in depth about... pretty much the whole thing, like what it means to DC, what it means to comics, what it meant as an event, and does it still matter? Is it relevant to the current DC storytelling that's happening right now? So we've got a lot to talk about. I've been doing a reread of it, and it is fascinating stuff. And the George Perez art is just this. This is meat and potatoes, man. This is like, yeah. This is some of the best that DC has ever produced.
Absolutely. All right, well, be on the lookout for that, guys. Be on the lookout, of course, for another edition of Marvel Age Masterclass. We'll be coming for you soon. On Twitter, Russell, where can people find you?
You can get me at Russell_Sellers. Hit that follow. I'll tweet a whole bunch of useless crap along with some fun comic stuff too, and we're getting close to my favorite time of year, which is football season, so get ready for a whole bunch of Crimson Tide tweeting and retweeting and me outing myself as not really knowing enough about the game of football to have an in-depth discussion of it. So, but I am a fan. I watch every game that I can possibly get to on Saturdays and on Sundays too. So if you are an Atlanta Falcons fan, you're going to really love following me. If you're not, you're going to hit that mute button real fast.
Awesome stuff, Russell. Of course, you guys can find me at Ben J. Morse on Twitter, at BenMorse882 on Instagram. I've got to go put my daughter to bed. So I'm going to say goodbye, Russell. I'm going to say goodbye to you, all of the great listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in to Marvel Age Masterclass, to Marvel Age, to Place to Be Nation. Pop! And we appreciate it. Russell, any final words?
It's been another fun time here on the Masterclass. Always love hearing what you got to say, Ben, and discussing comics with you. It's one of the most fun things that we get to do here. So,
you are too kind, sir. Too kind. Russell will be back, and we'll all be back. But until next time, class dismissed.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We'll be right back.